Welcome to the London Walks podcast.
This episode, Shakespeare and London, written and presented by David Tucker.
I call it the Mahler moment on my Shakespeare in London walk. It's the moment when a centuries-old neighborhood snaps into focus. The moment everything comes together. The voila moment. The moment when you can suddenly see Shakespeare's neighborhood. See what it was like. See where he lived in it. And what that meant for his art. We've threaded our way through the dark streets and alleys of Jacobean London to a medieval church. Directly across from us, on a corner, is a timber-framed house. There's a lit candle in an upstairs room. Shakespeare's in that room. He's a lodger in that house. This is the early 1600s. He's there for several years, years in which he'll write, in that room, Othello, King Lear, Measure for Measure, Timon of Athens, All's Well That Ends Well, and very likely Troilus and Cressida. The Mountjoy family, the people who are renting this spare room in their house to Master Shakespeare, as their maid calls him, are immigrants. They're Huguenots, 16th century boat people. It's possible to see the house to this day, see it after a fashion, and we'll do that. But first, the neighborhood. The neighborhood in relation to the plays Shakespeare wrote in that room on Silver Street. Just south of the house, 100 yards or so, Love Lane. So-called of wantons, is how John Stowe, the great 16th century gazetteer, delicately puts it in The Survey of London. And westward, ho? The St. Sepulchre's neighborhood, a world of sleaze and prostitutes, of pimps and thieves and con men and prisons. For the record, one of the brothels there was operated by George Wilkins, who, incredible this, co-authored Pericles with Shakespeare. Wilkins was a nasty piece of work, a charge sheet as long as your arm, including, I'm quoting here, kicking a woman on the belly, which was then great with child. And just north of the St. Sepulchre's neighborhood, Clerkenwell. Equally sordid, equally tawdry. This is Shakespeare's London, his neighborhood. But it could have sat, indeed, surely it did sit, for the portrait of Vienna in Measure for Measure. Sleaze, prostitutes, pimps, thieves, conmen, prisons, brothels, corruption in high places. That's Vienna in Shakespeare's Measure for Measure. But it's also his London. His London is Vienna by another name, and it smells just as rank. Now about the Mountjoys, those foreigners under whose roof Shakespeare lived. They were where you'd expect them to be. The greatest concentration of immigrants in England was just round the corner from Silver Street in the St. Martin's Le Grand district. And just north of the Silver Street house was the so-called Jew's Garden. In Stowe's words, it was the only place appointed them in England wherein to bury their dead till the year 1177. All of which Shakespeare will have registered. Will have registered at the very time he was writing his great tragedy about the ultimate foreigner, the ultimate outsider, the ultimate alien, Othello. And as for King Lear, which was also written in that house, the Mountjoys were a dysfunctional family. The daughter and her husband ended up suing her father, stiff-necked old man Mountjoy, because he hadn't made good on a dowry he'd promised the young couple. The case went to trial. Shakespeare figured in that trial. He made a deposition. He knew the principals. He was living under their roof. That deposition has survived. I show it to people on my walk. It ends with the world's most valuable signature, Shakespeare's signature. And what's King Lear about it? The greatest play Shakespeare ever wrote is about a hugely dysfunctional family. Families plural, if you count the subplot. About generational strife, father-daughter strife. about the ties of kinship that don't bind, that lacerate, about estrangement, alienation within a family, let alone an outsider of sorts, an alien figure, Edmund, who wreaks havoc. And Troilus and Cressida. Shakespeare's neighbor was Thomas Speight, the great Elizabethan Chaucer scholar. In 1602, Speight brought out a new edition of Chaucer's works. One of Chaucer's works was his poem about Troilus and Cressida. Some say it's Chaucer's greatest poem, surpassing the Canterbury Tales. But the point here is that neighbor Speight's complete works of Chaucer came out right about the time neighbor Shakespeare was writing his dramatic version of the Troilus and Cressida story. Influence? Did they talk? Exchange ideas? Were books handed back and forth? Well, what do you think? What does your common sense tell you? What mine is telling me is, how can they not have known each other? Especially given that in his will, Speight named St. Olaf, Silver Street, Shakespeare's church, as one of his two preferred burial places. And finally, London's killing fields, Smithfield, right there too, just to the west of the Silver Street neighborhood. Animals were bought, sold, and slaughtered there. Human beings were merely slaughtered. Protestant martyrs burned to death at the stake, for example. Or William Wallace, Braveheart, hanged, drawn, and quartered at Smithfield. But the Smithfield historical episode that's got cold, steely fingers that always clutch my throat is the execution of Edward Arden. In 1583, Shakespeare was 19 years old. Shakespeare's mother was an Arden. Edward Arden was the head of the Arden family. Edward Arden's father was Shakespeare's mother's second cousin. Edward Arden was hanged, drawn, and quartered at Smithfield. His head was impaled on a spike on London Bridge Gatehouse. When Shakespeare, walking home to Silver Street from the Globe Theatre, approached London Bridge Gatehouse, did he avert his eyes? Or swallow hard and take a quick look? Or look steadily at what the weather and maggots and daws were doing to that head? That was his relative. Now, I don't know about you, but for me, executions are things that happen to strangers in Saudi Arabia or Texas. If that's my relative's head up on that stake, or if I'm living just a stone's throw away from where he was hideously put to death, I'm thinking about that all the time. I can't get it out of my mind. The horrible thing in the closet of my mind. And how can it have been any different for Shakespeare? It has to have colored his thinking about power and cruelty and terror and what we do to one another and fate and the brevity of life, about justice and injustice. Now think about Measure for Measure again. It's a play about justice. Remember how it opens. Duke Vincentio, the big man in Vienna, enters. He calls for one of his attendant lords, calls him by name, Aeschylus. Aeschylus. Can you hear it? You should be able to. Aeschylus. You can hear it inside it. The word scales. The scales of justice. Justice. So there. The very first note sounded in that great play about justice and injustice. That play written not 100 yards from where Shakespeare's relative was put to an unimaginably cruel death in an act of justice. In that great play about justice and injustice, the very first note sounded, the first word uttered in the play, it's virtually a trumpet call, is justice. Aeschylus. But there's something else, too. There's always something else with Shakespeare. There's an older Aeschylus, the classical Greek playwright Aeschylus. His name has a slightly different spelling. It's Aeschylus. His name means shame. Justice, shame. Shakespeare's London, his neighborhood. What went down there? What he saw and felt? What he thought? What he made of it, what we go in search of, what we find.
Shakespeare and London was written and presented by David Tucker. In part two of Shakespeare and London, Andy will be discussing The First Folio.
For details of the full programme of London Walks, London's best guided walking tours, go to www.walks.com. The London Walks podcast was an APB production.